So the plan for today is to do one more example that I didn't have time to do last time about manifolds in general, how to come up with manifolds. And then we're going to talk about tangent vectors and the tangent space on a manifold. Before we start, are there any questions about what we did last time? Anything that was not clear?
Can I ask about the definition of topological space?
Yes.
Because you say that given these three conditions, these sets are called open sets.
Yes.
This definition equivalent to what we know about open sets?
So if I understand the question correctly, is the definition that I gave about topological space, I'm saying we define open sets to be sets in this collection tau x. They have to satisfy this property. So is this equivalent to our usual concept of open sets? It is in the sense that if you look at Rn with the usual notion of open sets, they behave like this. So if you say the open sets on Rn are, and I gave the example last time, for example, we say in Rn we just use the open balls, then those are going to give the topology that's what you usually think of as topology. And it's going to work with that, and they satisfy the properties. If you take the union of them, it's still going to be open. If you take an intersection of them, it's still going to be open, and so on. That said, there are very weird examples of topologies where you can do different things. You could choose the thing that's called discrete topology, where every single set is open, every single subset of X is open. And that's going to be very different from the topology that you usually know on Rn. So you can give the same set different kinds of topologies. And if you do that, it's going to have different geometrical properties. So for our purposes, we're looking at things that look like Rn. So we care about the standard topology on Rn. The topology of manifolds is just induced from the atlas, so we don't need to define it. And if we are usually looking at some subset of Rn in terms of manifolds, we're always going to assume in this course that we're dealing with induced topology. So if we're dealing with the sphere, the topology should be the same as the topology that the sphere has as a subset of Rn. Although in general, you can do things that are different and you make the sphere look like something else. But that's not what we're doing right here. Any other questions? OK, so let's go on with the other example. So this is a bit less of an example in the sense that I'm not going to show you a specific manifold, but this is a generic way in which we can build a lot of possible manifolds. And this uses the implicit function theorem from calculus or analysis. Are you all familiar with implicit function theorem? OK, so we don't really need it right now. I'll just explain what it is a bit at the end. But let me just tell you how we build manifolds first. So the way we're going to build manifolds is this. Suppose we have a function, let's call it capital F, that goes from some open subset of Rn in the standard topology. Again, we're always using the standard topology on Rn. And this could be Rn itself, because remember that the set itself is always going to be open. And we want m to be less than n. So the dimension of the set we are sending stuff to is less than the dimension of the one we started with. If this function is C infinity in the sense of functions from Rn to Rm, so you can differentiate it however many times as you want, then the set m, which is the pre-image of 0, which really just means all of the set, the elements of the set U, I'm missing something here, such that f of x equals 0. So we're going to take all of those elements that are sent to 0 by this function. You can think of this in another way. You can think of these as being constraints on your points. So you have your set U in Rn, but then you want to say, well, I don't want all of them. I want the ones that satisfy a certain constraint. The constraint is in the form of a function that is 0 on these points. So this set is actually going to be a manifold. And it's going to be a smooth manifold. And the fact that it's smooth comes from the fact that this function is C infinity. And the topology and the differential structures are going to be inherited from Rn. The topology is going to be the same as the induced topology. The differential structure is going to come essentially from this function f, which is c infinity. So this is very important because this idea that we have n and m and the function that f of x equals 0 is a way of encoding that we have m constraints on a certain space. So examples of this will be f of xy equals x squared plus y squared minus 1 on R2, for example. Because in this case, f to the minus 1 of 0 is just going to be the sphere. Because if we set all these points equal to 0, then it means that x squared plus y squared must be equal to 1. You're taking exactly all the points in the sphere. So last time we saw the sphere with actual charts given to them. But in this case, you can just use this theorem to directly say, well, this is going to be a manifold. I can make this into a manifold in a way that's consistent with the topology that I want on it. So for those of you who are not familiar with the implicit function theorem, this is a theorem in calculus that essentially tells you that if you have a function of this form, for example, which equals to 0, so you know, let's just do two variables, so f of xy equals 0, then as long as the function is nice enough, which in our case is c infinity, but you could ask for it to be just continuous or c1 and so on, then locally, we can write, for example, y equals g of x or x equals h of y. So it's the thing that tells you that if you have an implicit equation, you can locally write it in terms of one variable is a function of the others. So for example, the circle, you could write y equals the square root of 1 minus x squared, or y equals minus the square root of 1 minus x squared, depending on where you are. Or you can say x is plus or minus the square root of 1 minus y squared. So the theorem, it just tells you that you can do this. It's a theorem about existence of these things. It doesn't tell you that these are the charts. So while this is very useful because it tells you that you can construct these manifolds, it doesn't actually tell you how to construct them. It doesn't give you the charts because it's an existence theorem, it's not constructive. So if you want the charts, you need to find this implicit function yourself, the way of writing one variable in terms of the other. So this is just a way of letting you know that all of these things that can be written as constraints on an open subset of Rn, then you can make them into manifolds relatively easily, as long as you are able to invert locally and write one variable in terms of the others, which often you can do. And so for example, and I'll probably put this in the tutorial, you could use these four functions that I wrote right here to create a chart for the sphere, in addition to the one that I showed before. Actually, this is not a sphere, what am I saying here? This is the circle. It's a one-dimensional manifold. The whole thing applies just the same, but obviously, this cannot be the sphere because we're in R2 and we have a circle. Is this somewhat clear? At the end of the day, what you need to remember is if you have a function which is of class C infinity and you look at all the points, they satisfy f of x equals 0, then the set of all these points is a manifold. That's the important thing for us. OK, so that was all about the actual definition of manifolds. Now we're going to talk about something a bit more interesting, which is the tangent space. The tangent space is a way to generalize the idea of, say, a tangent plane to a surface. So if we are in R3 and we have a surface, something like this, hopefully it looks somewhat curved, then at each point, we often are interested in the tangent plane at the point. So it's the plane that's tangent to the whole surface. And for example, usually in calculus, you do this with surfaces that are graphs of functions. So for example, it could be the set of all the points x, y, z, where z is a function of x, y. Incidentally, this is an example of what I just told you before. You can always think of this as being some function of x, y, z equals 0. So this is actually a constraint. It's a very easy constraint to solve because you can actually always explicitly write z as a function of x, y. That's why that's called the implicit function theorem. This is explicit because I'm telling you explicitly z is a function of x and y. The other one is telling you, yes, there is a way of writing that, at least locally, but I'm not telling you what it is. OK, so before we go on, do we need something in order to be able to do this, to construct a tangent plane, or we can do that for any kind of surfaces? And just think of this calculus example. We have z equals f of xy. Can f be any function you want, or does f need to have some special property if we want a tangent plane at a certain point? Yes? Yes, it needs to be differentiable. And in order to say something is differentiable, we need a differential structure. So the idea here is that we can only talk about tangent spaces for smooth manifolds, not for topological manifolds, which we didn't give a differential structure yet. So this is an important point. Remember, I was telling you last time that any set, you can make it into whatever you want. Sets without any additional structure are just collections of points, which you can make into whatever you want. The structure is given by this topological structure or manifold structure, the smooth manifold structure. So it's very important that we use this structure to our advantage. So we're going to see soon how that's done. But before doing the general manifold case, I'm just going to do the steps that we're going to do, but in Rn, because Rn is simple. So we're going to start with a manifold, which is just the whole of Rn, which, as we saw last time, is the easiest manifold we can build because it's just one chart, which is the identity, and it looks like Rn in an obvious way. Now, what is the tangent space to Rn? If the surface that we're looking at right here, instead of being this curved thing, it's just a plane, it's just the xy plane, then at each point, the tangent space is just R2 again. That should be relatively obvious. So we're going to call TPRN the tangent space at a point n. This is just a notation. So T stands for tangent, P is telling you what point we're looking at, and Rn is the name of the manifold. So in general, we will replace this with M. So in Rn, we have this situation. The manifold is Rn, and the tangent space is also Rn. But there is something important to know, and that is these two Rns are different kind of animals. The first one is a manifold. The second one is a vector space. And that's very important. They are not the same thing, but just because they are the same set, it's very easy to not being able to distinguish them. This is not going to happen with generic manifolds, so keep this thing in mind. Okay, so how are we going to come up with tangent vectors? First of all, what are the vectors tangent to? They are tangent, in this case, for example, to a surface, but they're also tangent to every curve on the surface that passes through the point. And this is the approach that we're going to take. Instead of looking at the surface, we're going to look at the curves on the surface. So let's look at curves in Rn. So suppose we have a curve that looks like this. We have gamma, which is a curve, and the curve is a function from an interval. I'm just going to call it minus epsilon to epsilon, so it includes 0. Epsilon is some positive number, epsilon greater than 0. It's a differentiable curve if we can take derivatives of it. So these are just curves in Rn, which I'm assuming you have all seen at some point in some vector calculus course. But if you're not, please let me know. So suppose you have this curve. and it's differentiable, so we can take derivatives. It also satisfies this property that it passes through P when the parameter is zero. We could have chosen something different. It can pass through P when the parameter is one, for example. But we can always reparameterize and make sure that this happens. So we can always do this. Then, if we take the derivative of this function at zero, I'm going to denote it by gamma prime at zero, and this is the limit as t goes to zero of gamma of t minus gamma of zero over t. So the usual definition of limits is just that these are points in Rn, so you're doing a subtraction of vectors. Then this is a vector tangent to Rn at p. And in fact, it's a vector tangent to the curve. So this is the tangent vector to the curve. If you think physically, what we're doing here, if gamma is a curve describing the path of a particle, then we're taking the velocity vector, which is always going to be tangent to the curve. If it's tangent to the curve, and the curve lives on a surface, then it's tangent to the surface. Yes?
Gamma maps to the manifold Rn, not the
Yes, very good point. So this is mapped to the manifold, not to the vector space. And then if you're wondering, well, then how do we take differences? We are using the fact that in Rn we can take the difference of things. This is not going to happen on a generic manifold, so we cannot do this for manifolds, which is the problem we're trying to solve. OK, so if I give you a curve, then I can make out of it a tangent vector. Now, conversely, if I give you a tangent vector, so v is a vector in TPRN, then I can always choose this curve. I'm just going to take the point P, and then I'm going to add to it T times v. So this satisfies the gamma of 0 equals P. It's also differentiable because it's a linear thing in T. So automatically, we're going to get the gamma prime of 0 is v. So conversely, if I give you a tangent vector, I can always find the curve to which it is tangent. So you can start to see here that we can kind of take curves and vectors and just think of them as being the same thing. And this is important because it means that if we have a curve, I can associate to it a vector, even if I don't know how to actually do it specifically. Like in this case, we know that we can take the derivative and we get the vector. But in general, we're just going to have this idea, well, a curve corresponds to a vector, and vice versa. There's only one problem. So we want to identify these tangent vectors with the curves. The problem is there are many curves that have the same tangent vector. So we're going to need to take equivalence classes. We're going to say that two curves are equivalent if they have the same tangent vector. And then we're going to map one-to-one equivalence classes of curves to tangent vectors. That's the plan. So we're going to do something like this. Equivalence class of gamma is going to be mapped to tangent vector. And as I pointed out before, you can go in one direction and the other. If I have a vector, then I can construct the gamma to which it is tangent. If I have gamma, then I can find the tangent vector. So that's the plan. I hope this is not too confusing, but we're going to go through this whole thing again more formally now for manifolds. This was just to give you an idea of exactly what we're trying to do. Now, one thing to point out is in Rn, this whole exercise is completely pointless. We're wasting time because in Rn, vectors are just vectors in Rn. We don't need to do all this. The reason why we need it is that manifolds are not just the same as Rn. Any questions before I move to the next step? Yes?
Still confused by the logic here. Maybe it'll be cleared up later. Gamma is a map from R to Rn, the manifold Rn?
Yes.
Why are we allowed to add gamma t and gamma 0?
So the question is, if gamma goes to the manifold and not to the vector space, why can we do this? That's a good question. So I think it is going to become clearer when we look at the manifold thing. Because when we do something like this in the manifold thing, we are going to first map to the vector space. So here we're kind of skipping the step because the map is the identity. But I think I might have been confusing you when I said this. We have to consider differently the manifold than the vector space. It is true that there's the manifold Rn and the vector space Rn, but we can still make use of the fact that Rn is a vector space, even for the manifold. We're not going to forget that we can add things in Rn. Any other questions? OK, so I'm hoping that it's going to become clear once we actually see what's happening here. But if it's not clear, then we can revisit this as soon as I told you about what happens with manifolds. OK, so we're going to use a manifold, M. It needs to be smooth, otherwise we cannot do any of this. And let's fix the dimension of M to be N. So whenever I say Rn in here, that's because N is the dimension of the manifold. So first of all, let's define what the curve is in this case. We're going to say that the curve at a point, which is just a fancy way of saying it's a curve that passes through the point, is going to be some map which goes from an open interval in R to R manifold M. So this is an open interval. And we're going to have 0 is in this interval. And also gamma of 0 is the point. So same as before, this curve passes through the point when the parameter is 0. And then we're going to say that gamma is of class C1, so it's continuously differentiable, if, and this I hope answers the question that Matthew had, we cannot do subtraction of points anymore. We cannot take the derivative of it anymore. So what we do instead is use the fact that the manifold looks like Rn. So we're going to take a chart that contains the point. So P must be in the chart. And then we're going to consider this composite function. We're going to compose gamma with phi. So this is now a function that goes from the interval Rm. Therefore, because it's a function from R to Rm, we can take derivatives of it. It makes perfect sense to take derivatives. So yes, in this case, this is a vector space. So what happened before, when there was the confusion, was that we were doing this step by mapping Rn to the vector space Rn, but I didn't do it because the map was just the identity. So this is how we define something to be continuously differentiable. The point here is that we don't know how to take derivatives on M at all. What we do know is how to map M to Rn. Then in Rn, we know how to take derivatives, so we do it there. That's going to be the whole way we do all of these things for manifolds. We're going to see next week how we define continuity and differentiability for functions between manifolds, and it's going to be the same idea. Just map everything to Rm and Rn, do everything there, then just bring the information back with you. OK, so this is a curve at P. And then we're going to define two curves at P, gamma 1 and gamma 2, to be equivalent if they have the same derivative in a certain chart. So again, we take a chart, we take the composition. So these two things are functions. They go from some interval, let's just say they go from R to Rm, or at least some subset of R to Rm. So we can take derivatives of them. And if two derivatives match in the same chart, then we're going to say that these two curves, gamma 1 and gamma 2, are equivalent. So same idea as before. We don't know how to take derivatives, but we know how to do that in Rm. So we take both charts. We map them to Rn. If they have the same tangent vector there, then we say they have the same tangent vector also in the manifold. Now, I'm not saying this explicitly, but I'm always saying, like, choose a chart, but there are many charts. It just so happens that if you choose a different chart and it worked in one of them, it's going to work in the other. So if it works in one chart, it works in all of them. And this is just a property of the transition maps of the atlas. We don't need to look into this. I'm just letting you know in case you're interested, because it may look like, where's the atlas? We only chose one possible chart. So once you have this, we're done. The plan, again, was identify vectors with equivalence classes or curves. So we're going to define the tangent space at a point P in the manifold as this set. It's going to be the set of all the equivalence classes of curves of class C1 passing through the point, which, as you may imagine, is a weird set because it doesn't contain vectors. It contains equivalence classes, which are sets of curves, which are functions. So we have this weird set of sets of functions, and we want to make it into a vector space. Now, just a note before we go on, this is one of the possible ways to define the tangent space. If you have seen other ways already, you might be a bit confused. Another way of defining tangent vectors is as differential operators. We're not going to do that in this course, but that's another way of approaching the same kind of problem. OK, so before we go to the next step, is this clear? I know it's very abstract, because we are obviously building a very abstract set. But the whole point here is this allows us to talk about tangent vectors on manifolds that are not just subset of Rn. They can be any kind of weird set that you want. And this is especially interesting for physics, because, for example, in general relativity, space-time is a manifold. And because space-time is the whole thing, we cannot think of space-time as being a subset of something else. It doesn't make any physical sense. So we do need an intrinsic way of defining these things without referring to something outside. So philosophically speaking, this is actually important in physics. And in fact, I think it's more important in physics than in math, in a sense, because you usually care about things that are embedded into something else. OK, so now the important question is, I built this set. Is this a vector space? Because we're calling these tangent vectors. If they're vectors, they need to be in a vector space. Otherwise, they're not vectors. So what do you think? Is this thing that I built a vector space? Let's do it differently. Who thinks this is a vector space? Okay, so I see a few hands. So you think this is a vector space? Well, I'm afraid to tell you that that's not true yet. This is just a set. It has a bunch of stuff in it. But the vector space needs something more. So in order to make this into a vector space, I need to tell you, how do you add the two equivalence classes? How do I scale to an equivalence class? And I didn't tell you that. So right now, it's not a vector space. We need to make it into one. And that's the next thing we're going to do. To do that, we're going to construct an isomorphism with Rn. We're going to look at this map. So the name for the map is not going to be obvious at all now. This is going to become clear when you see differential forms. But we are calling it D of phi. Phi is the chart that we're working with. It's the chart from before. P is the point. So this is just a way of giving a function name that depends on both the chart and the point. And the D happens to be an operator that acts on functions, but you're going to see that later. This function works like this. It takes an equivalence class in the tangent space, and it attaches to it phi composed with gamma. Then you take the derivative of this, and you evaluate it at zero. So it's exactly the thing that attaches to a curve, its tangent vector when you map it to Rn. Now, this curve is, first of all, well-defined. That's the classic question whenever you have a function that involves equivalence classes. Does it depend on the choice of representative? It does not, because two curves are equivalent exactly if they are mapped to the same thing. That's the whole definition of them being equivalent. So it's well-defined. The same property also tells you that it's injective, because two things that are in the same equivalence class are being sent to the same thing, but also two things sent to the same vector in Rn, they are in the same equivalence class by definition. So this means that any two things are only sent to the same object if they are the same initially. So it's injective. And finally, it's surjective. Now, this is a bit less obvious to see, but the idea is that if I give you any vector v in Rn, then I can always choose phi composed gamma as a function of t to be that simple p plus tv that we've seen before. And this means the gamma is going to be phi to the minus 1 of, this should be phi of p, not p. So this is going to be phi of p plus tv. So obviously, this satisfies all the properties that we want. It's going to be a curve. It satisfies gamma of 0 equals p, because at 0, you just have phi to the minus 1 of phi of p, which is p. And the derivative of this thing is just going to be v. So just as before, we've seen that every vector corresponds to a tangent to a curve, the same thing happens here. So anytime you pick something in Rn, you can build some gamma that is mapped to this vector by this function. So this is surjective. So we have an invertible function. So we're almost there. We have an invertible function between Rn and our hypothetical vector space. Does this make it into isomorphism, or we're still missing something? Yes?
That theoretical, yes, we still need to find addition.
Yes, so you're saying as sets, yes, they are isomorphic in the sense that they are the same set, essentially. Up to, you relabel stuff, and it becomes Rn. But as we've seen already a few times now, that doesn't mean much, because we need more structure. So we need the vector space structure. And to do that, we need to say, how do we sum things, and how do we scale them? Well, the thing is, I don't know how to do that. But I have an invertible map. So what I'm going to do is a nice trick, and I'm just going to steal the vector space structure from Rn. So we're going to take the vector space in Rn, and we're going to borrow it in such a way that this function is an isomorphism. So we're going to make it into an isomorphism, whether it likes to or not. And to do this, we're just going to define things this way. So let A and B be any real numbers. They're just scaling stuff. And gamma 1, equivalence class of gamma 1, equivalence class of gamma 2, two vectors. Then we're going to just say that a linear combination of these two things is defined like this. We have the inverse function d phi p to the minus 1, and we evaluate it at a times the function acting on gamma 1 plus b the function acting on gamma 2. Now, why am I doing it this way? Well, if you take this d5p to the minus one, and you just bring it to the other side, by which I mean you just apply it on both sides, the function, this tells us that d5p of a gamma 1 plus b gamma 2, this is a d5p gamma 1 plus b d5p of gamma 2. Which is exactly the definition of this mapping linear. So all we did is take this function and make sure it's linear. And by the way, you can use this trick with anything. So any vector, or any set that has the same cardinality as Rn, you can make it into a vector space in exactly the same way. The reason why this works for us is that, first of all, this is kind of natural in the sense that we're not coming up with some weird function. We are using the stuff we have already, which is the charts. But also, it's consistent with everything we need. So it's the consistency that's going to make it work. So given this thing, now we actually have a vector space. So the tangent space is made up of real vectors now, because we know how to add them. And notice that, again, all we're doing is we don't know how to add things, so we map them to Rn, then we add them there, and then we bring the result back. This is the whole thing that we do in manifolds all the time. Whenever you don't know how to do something, well, go to Rn, do it there, and then bring the result back. That's manifolds in a nutshell. Now, some notes. Because the isomorphism is with Rn, this means that the dimension of the tangent space is the same as the dimension of the manifold, and it's n. This is always going to be true. So the dimension of the tangent space is the same as the dimension of the manifold. That's consistent with surfaces having tangent planes and curves having tangent lines. So that's a good thing. But also, if you have two different charts, one is phi and the other one is psi, for example, and you construct the same thing in both charts, they're going to be different isomorphisms. So that's very important. This is chart dependent. So while you can do it, it really depends on which chart you're using. And of course, we're not showing all of these things, but if you have two compatible charts, by which I mean they both work at the same point, then this construction actually makes sense. You don't get different answers that would invalidate what you're doing. Any questions about this thing? OK, so now we're going to make it less abstract by working with the usual vectors, which you've probably seen already if you've seen general relativity. So we're going to work with coordinate-induced bases. So instead of working with these weird equivalence classes, which are good from the point of view of giving us a structure, but if you actually want to work with things, they are terrible, because they are sets that contain curves. That's a very bad thing. So instead, we want to work with nice vectors. So you know how we stole the vector space structure from Rn? Well, we're also going to steal a basis from Rn. Since d phi p is an isomorphism, we can just use it to take all of the basis elements in Rn and just bring them back with the inverse map. And from Millian algebra, you may remember that if you do this, a basis is always mapped to a basis using a linear map. An invertible linear map. So an isomorphism maps basis to basis, and the inverse isomorphism does the same thing. So some notation, we're going to call EI the standard basis in Rn. So the standard basis means that E1 is the vector that has 1, 0, 0, 0, and so on. Then E2 is 0, 1, 0, 0, and so on. OK, so suppose we have this chart phi. Now, because phi is a function that goes from U to Rn, then instead of thinking it as one function, we can think of it as n functions that go from U to R. And we're going to then write phi equals this set of n functions. So it's the usual take a vector function, make it into a bunch of scalar function kind of thing, which I hope you've seen before. We're going to call these functions x1, x2, and so on, because they actually give us the coordinates of the point. So x1 of a point gives you the first coordinate of the point. X2 gives you the second coordinate of the point, and so on. So it makes sense to call them like this. The only reason why I'm introducing this is that it gives us a reason why we use this notation now. So we're going to define these vectors, and we're going to give them this strange notation, which makes them look like differential operators. And it's the partial derivative with respect to xi. And then we have this evaluated at p, just to remember that we are at the point p, not anywhere else. And these are just the pre-image of elements of the standard basis. So as I was saying, we take the basis in Rn, bring it back to our vector space. So this is a vector in TPM. So technically, yes, it's an equivalence class, but it doesn't matter. We give it a name, and that's what we're going to use. Once you have a basis, then everything just becomes coefficients with respect to a basis. So we never have to worry about working with equivalence classes again. So a note on the notation. As I mentioned earlier, another way of thinking of vectors for a manifold is as differential operators. So this notation comes from exactly that approach. We're going to use it because, first of all, it's the standard notation, so everyone uses this notation. But also, as we'll see at the end of the lecture, it makes very much sense when you want to look at change of basis. Any questions before we go on? One thing to keep in mind is that this is a definition, but once you define this, you never actually have to do this. You can just work directly with these vectors. So no one's ever going to ask you, or you're never going to have to do it in real life, this particular step. You don't need to look at what this map looks like. You don't need to actually map this thing back, because it doesn't matter. You can do it if you want, but it's not something that actually matters. You can just go directly and say, well, these are my coordinate induced vectors. And that's it. So now the question becomes, as I said before, if you have a different chart, you're going to get a different isomorphism. Therefore, you're going to get a different basis. So if the chart is now psi, and the components of the charts are y1, y2, all the way to yn, then we're going to define, in the same way, these new vectors, d over dy, I, evaluated at p. And this is going to be the pre-image with this other isomorphism, which is a different one. But because these are bases, this vector can be written as a linear combination of the old bases. I'm using here Einstein's notation to avoid writing sums. Is everyone here familiar with Einstein's notation? OK, great. So the goal, and that's the last thing we have to do in this lecture, is figuring out what are these coefficients? What do they look like? Because if we know these, then we know how to change basis, and we're done. And once we get to it, they are most likely going to look very familiar, because you're going to have seen these things many times in general relativity. OK, well, let's do all the steps. First of all, let's not forget that this vector is actually an equivalence class of curves. So this is going to be equal to the equivalence class of gamma, where gamma is some curve that we don't know that satisfies this. Psi composed gamma, you take the derivative, you evaluate at zero, and you're going to get exactly this vector. This just comes from the fact that we are using this function. Remember, the way the function works is that it maps gamma to this thing. Well, we're doing the pre-image of AI, which means we need to map to AI. So any ideas of how we can choose the function gamma of t in such a way that this result is obtained? In a simple way, there are a lot of different options, but one of them is relatively simple. I can give you some hint. We've done this already before when we wanted to find a gamma that did what we wanted. Yes?
Something plus.
Yes, so it's going to be like before, some inverse of some straight line. That's the simplest thing we can do. So specifically, we're going to write, this time we're using the map psi, so it's going to be psi to the minus 1 of psi of p plus EI. That's the simplest thing we can think of that satisfies this. Because now you compose with psi, psi cancels out the psi to the minus 1, and this is just going to be a straight line passing through this point in the direction EI. You take the derivative, and the tangent vector is exactly EI. So why are we doing this? Well, we're doing this because we're interested in looking at this. What happens when we take this function, the one in the first chart, phi, and we apply it to this vector, which is the basis in the second chart? Well, now, by definition, this is going to be the same as d phi p of gamma, which, remember, just maps to phi composed gamma prime at zero. But this is, because of the form that we're giving to gamma, just phi composed, actually that's a derivative in front. So we're taking the derivative with respect to t. We evaluate at t equals zero. And then we're going to have phi composed psi to the minus 1. And this thing is going to be evaluated at gamma. Sorry, I already put part of gamma in here, it's going to be evaluated at phi of p plus e i. The reason why this is helpful is that now these are all nice functions, in the sense that this function that we're going to call theta is a function that goes from Rn to Rn. Or at least some subset of Rn. This function is just a curve that goes from R to Rn. So we can actually take this derivative using calculus. And you need to use the chain rule in order to do this properly. But eventually, what you get is this. So we need to take the derivative of this thing first, so we take partial derivatives. So we're going to have d theta, let's call it j, over dy k. And we evaluate this thing evaluated at zero. So just this. If these steps seem a bit weird to you, just look at them later with calm and just remember how these things work in calculus. And then we're going to have the derivative of this thing evaluated at t. But then we're going to have the kth component because we need to contract with this. So we have the kth component of ei, which is delta ai. And then finally, because this thing is a vector, we get ej. So this goes with this. So eventually, if we use the fact that there's a delta, this is just d theta j over yi at psi of p times dj. And we're summing over all the j's. So this particular step, I know I'm going a bit fast over it. But again, if you are unsure, you can just look at it with calm. If it's still unclear, you can just ask me. OK, so now we're almost done because we are looking at this particular thing here. Can I go on to the next step, or is someone still writing this? Okay, I'm going to move on. All these steps are in the lecture notes anyway. I'm not skipping anything there. So if we look at this, there's another way of looking at it, and that's d phi p of alpha j I d over dxi, dxj. Because that's what we want to do in the end. Now, because this is a linear map, this is the same as pulling out the alphas. And then we have d phi p acting on d over dxjp. But this is just alpha j I ej. So now we have these two things, they equal each other and they are linear combination of a basis. And the only way these two things can be equal is if all the coefficients are the same. So this tells us eventually that these alpha j I are exactly these derivatives. And this tells us how to go from one basis to the other. So the final result is d over dy I p is just going to be theta j over dy I evaluated at psi of p times d over dx j evaluated at p. So this is the result that we want in the end. And this is almost the thing that you've probably seen many times. But what you usually see is something that uses a bit of abusive notation. And what's happening is this. Theta j is psi j composed phi to the minus 1. Oh, sorry, it's phi j composed to phi to the minus 1. But remember that phi j, we call it x j. So these things are almost the functions x. So what people usually do is write things with this slight abuse of notation, and that's dyi p equals dxj over dyi psi of p over dxj. What's happening here is that dx technically do not depend directly on the y functions because they are functions from the manifold. But you are abusing the notation as thinking of them as being dependent on the y's. You are essentially skipping the explicit step where you plug in the psi to the minus 1. And this thing has the very nice property that is very easy to remember because you're just essentially, in a sense, multiplying and dividing by this thing. which is also why people like very much this notation with the partial derivatives. That's because you can just use this property all the time. Now, when I say that you've seen this many times, you've probably seen it in reverse, in the sense that if you look at components of in these spaces, then the components transform with these matrices. But that's just the reverse side of the same picture. So what we're doing here is just look at how the basis change. If you know how the basis change, then you also know how the components change. Okay, so that's the whole part of theory for today. And I hope it's not too weird. I know this part is very abstract. So if there are any questions, you can ask me at any time. Since we have a few minutes, I just wanted to show you a simple example of these things. Unless there are questions, and if you would rather ask questions, you can do that. So any questions? Okay, so then I'll just show you the example, which hopefully is going to make things a bit clearer. The example is this. We're going to consider this manifold, and we're already going to consider it parameterized in a sense. So we're going to essentially look at polar coordinates. Now, polar coordinates are nice and well defined when r is 0 and theta is between minus pi and pi excluded. If you include one of the pi's, then you are only excluding the origin, but when you try to invert them, you're going to have a jump. So the inverse function is not continuous anymore. So if you do this, we're essentially considering the plane, but we're removing a whole negative x-axis and zero. So it looks like this. We had the plane, and then we're removing a whole line and a point. We can make it into a manifold, and we're going to do that with two different charts. One of them is the identity chart, because this is just an open subset of Rn. The other one is polar coordinates. And polar coordinates work like this. So if you want to assign r and theta to some points a and b in the plane, then we're going to define them this way. R is just the square root of the sum of the squares. And theta is going to be given by the inverse tangent, but you need to account for which quadrant you're in. So you use the a tan 2 function. If you're not familiar with this, it doesn't really matter at this point. You can just look it up later. And the inverse function of phi is the usual polar coordinates function. If you have r and theta, you can find x and y by doing r cosine theta, r sine theta. So the reason why I'm showing you this is that you can now find out what this basis looks like. So in the chart phi, the basis is going to be d over dr at p, d over d theta at p. While in the other chart, the basis is just d over dx at p, d over dy. So if you want to explicitly find out what the basis is, you just need to find those derivatives. So if you take the derivative of x with respect to r, and remember that this is not really x, but this is going to be the identity function composed with phi to the minus 1. So it's essentially phi to the minus 1. So you're taking this derivative. The x component is this one. So you just get cosine theta when you derive with respect to r. So the other one, you just get sine theta. And so eventually, this is how you convert from one to the other. So you can actually do all of these things once you know the function. And that's helpful. And you've probably seen this already. Like, you've probably seen spherical coordinates at some point in general relativity. And that's just the extension of these three dimensions. The other thing that I wanted to show you, we have no time for it. I'm just going to tell you what it is. It's in the lecture notes. And because we're actually living in Rn, in this case, we have a subset of R2, you can actually visualize these vectors in the sense that if this vector is an equivalence class of a curve, and you choose the curve to be the nice one, the simple example, which is just the image of a line, then you can actually plot it. Because these functions are all RM functions, you can write down exactly what it is. I'm not going to do that, but the answer is in the lecture notes if you're interested. If you want to see exactly what they are, I have them here. And that's what they look like. The curve, the one in the direction of theta is just a circle that passes through this point. The other one is a line, passes through the origin and goes to the point. And the vector basis d over dr is a vector sticking out. And the other one is orthogonal to it, and it just goes in the opposite direction. In with the charts I chose, goes counterclockwise. So this is a way you can visualize things in this way, and you can see it kind of makes somewhat sense. Okay, that's all for today. I hope this wasn't too confusing, and I'll see you tomorrow.